Hey, welcome listeners. Here is yet another episode of Escape from Plan A for you. We are approaching episode number 400.
Whoa.
Can you believe it?
Wow.
This is Chris, your host here with Adam and Teen.
What's up?
Yellow.
That means we've hung out 400 times.
At least.
At least.
Times at least. Speaking of hanging out, first, I just wanted to quickly go over what this episode is so you guys know what you're in for. So I'm sure a lot of you follow Teen on Twitter. You may have realized that you know you can't find him anymore. He hasn't been kicked off. He has voluntarily taken the... Okay, Teen, why don't you explain? Just like very quickly before we delve into
I deactivated my account. It's on the countdown. So if you deactivate on Twitter, you have a 30-day countdown. If you don't log back in for 30 days, you're gone. Deleted.
It's done. Nuked.
Nuked.
All right.
And I don't know, like I want to nuke it, but my wife has been like, why? Log back in. So I'm like the one guy who quit Twitter whose wife is like, you shouldn't quit Twitter. I'm like, baby, I gotta quit Twitter.
it's like the Panic in Needle Park where the couple is like mutually destructive, you know, keeping each other hooked on heroin, except it's Twitter. So anyway, yeah, we'll get more deeply into why you and Adam, you said you've kind of done the same thing, right?
Well, I haven't actually deactivated it yet, but I haven't logged in probably a month.
Yeah.
And,
just
I deleted it from my phone just a couple of days ago. So I'm not even, I can't like even accidentally hit it.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about, you know, what motivates people to do that and what comes next and all that. But, and then we'll talk about this Nation article that came out a couple of weeks ago. This talking about how the Stop Asian Hate movement has gotten derailed by certain wrong actors. It was a article written by Seth Berkman. It came to my attention because our friends over at Dragon Combat really hated the piece. So a couple of weeks is a bit late, but I thought we should still talk about it. But before we get to the main topics, you guys brought up hanging out. I do want to talk about, so Adam, me, Trevor, and Mtume, we went out to Red Hook Lobster Pound in Red Hook. Because it was a lobster week, and we had a great dinner.
Keen,
you were obviously invited, but you're in Maryland, so unfortunately, you missed out, my friend. You also missed out on watching Pearl for free with me and my other friend on Friday.
Again, I wanted to see that movie, but
it is so good. You should watch it. But I would recommend watching X before it, even though
it's like Pearl is kind of a sequel to X, right?
Oh, it's a prequel. Though I guess it was made right after they made it kind of. You know the way they made the Lord of the Rings, just like one after another. But yeah, chronologically in the movie verse, Pearl takes place before X, but it was like in the real world made after it. But oh, such a good movie.
Ty West, right?
T West or Ty West? Who knows how you pronounce
it? He's excellent. Like House of the Devil, although he's fantastic.
Yeah, I've been getting more into horror. I've never been a horror fan, but I'm kind of getting more into it lately. I think it's because it's one of the few genres now where you can actually feel something, whereas everything else is so sterilized, sanitized, you know, kind of focus group. But you know, these movies, you watch people's getting heads getting chopped off. You and I think my theory is that because you're allowed to kill off the characters, you're allowed to make them say things that don't have to be virtuous. Because like, hey, you're gonna kill them off, so they don't have to be role models. So then you get a lot of
how fucked is your generation? You're like watching someone getting beheaded, and then Chris,
that's the only way I can feel.
I feel something, guys. I feel something.
Oh boy!
But anyway, at dinner last night, so, Trevor. Okay, I'm gonna put him on blast here because he said something that was so. It just made me shake my head at how. it was lobster dinner, basically like half off. And we were, you know, all three of us were getting lobster dinners, but he wanted to get fish and chips.
That's right.
And then after he places the order, he asks us, guys, actually, is fish and chips healthier than lobster? No, I think he ordered the lobster, but he wanted to switch to fish and chips, but he wanted to know what was healthier.
Lobster.
And I'm just thinking, fish and chips.
He's watching his cholesterol, which I respect. I mean,
fish and chips has got to be one of the worst things to eat.
But I think shellfish has a lot of cholesterol.
That's what he was saying. I didn't know because I have no idea.
Regardless, I would think anything that's deep fried is 100 times worse than anything that's merely boiled.
Probably.
So I thought he just like really wanted to eat fish and chips, but felt bad about ordering. So he wanted like a way out for somehow maybe fish and chips was healthier than lobster. But that made me shake my head. But
Yeah, it was anyway. Funny though, mm-hmm. because no, he did order it first, and then we talked him into getting the lobster. So he like he ran out of the like he ran to like get our waitress to.
Where were you at? Was this the where in Red Hook were you?
Red Hook Lobster Pound.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, a really good place. We want to go back to it because there's a lot of good dishes there.
Is that on? Try. It's on Van. What's that?
Van Bright. Van Bright. However,
yeah,
something like that.
Yes, that's yeah. It's on Van. Whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Red Hook's a cool area. It's very, it's kind of hard to get to, but if you have a city bike, you just have to, I got off at Borough Hall and then just biked down there. And a friend and I had gone on a, just like a weekend biking trip around the area. So even though it was dark, days are so dark nowadays. I was so, like, I thought, I'd made a reservation for 7:30. I thought that by then it would still be light out, but I made the reservation like weeks ago. Yeah. So it was dark.
Do you know, if you go all the, if you keep going down, you get to that Fairway Market. Have you been there?
No.
Okay, so there's a Fairway Market sort of at the end that's like right on the water, and above, sort of like above and appurtenant to it are these like artist loft apartments. Mm. And one time I went to go buy a chair like off Craigslist, and the woman who was selling it lived in one of those apartments. So I was kind of excited because I'd never been inside one of them. I go inside. Dude, it's amazing. Incredible. Huge.
They're
apartment.
Huge, right?
Huge apartment. And yeah. It like they have these like these sort of these giant like arched windows.
Yeah.
And the whole thing's made of brick, like her brick walls and everything. And then these arched windows and you can't see anything but the harbor. So it looks like you're on a ship. You can't see any from if you're like sitting at her table, you can't see anything but
just like
the harbor and ships. You cannot see the ground. So it feels like you're in a like a in a ship yourself.
But it's like just one big room, right? Like the lofts are basically just one.
It was an apartment. It had been subdivided and stuff.
Okay.
But I was like, dude, these apartments are fucking sick.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure. The big trade off would have been in times past that it's kind of inaccessible. So if you happen to work, even in like somewhere else in Brooklyn, it would have been hard to get to. But I'm sure in the last couple of years, if you can work from home. And you can get a place like that, and I'm sure the rents are pretty low. It's probably gentrifying, every second, exponentially, exponentially. Because it's like the one drawback to it was it's hard to get to, but if you don't have to go anywhere, at least to commute, why not?
Yeah. I should have become friends with her just to go hang out in her apartment. It was so cool. I don't know. It was just really neat. It had a whole maritime thing, you know.
Pretend like you're on a boat.
It's amazing. Anyway.
Yeah, anyway. So that was us last night. But okay, so moving on to this thing about quitting Twitter. Teen, why don't we start with you? So when did this idea first come to you? Like, I should try weaning myself off.
Well, I told you last time I quit like Netflix, and then I've just been thinking like, I don't know, Twitter is... I kind of knew that Twitter was not behaviorally like the best thing to do. And, because it has like this addictive quality or whatever. And then I just thought about it and I was like, you know, what's going on is like, it's kind of driving me mad because it's the same thing every day. It's the same set of stuff that I'm getting pissed about. It's the same calling out the same xenophobic articles, calling out the same, you know, the Seth Berkman type article in The Nation. This is far from the first one we've seen. And it's the same people who, a lot of people I like on Twitter, it's not, no knock on them, but it became a circle jerk. And then I realized I am on a loop. It's a Groundhog's Day situation. I wake up every day and it was starting to make every day feel the same. I was not having different intellectual or psychological or emotional experiences. It was being anchored by my Twitter experience, and I was therefore living the same day over and over, and I'm like, I'm pretty bored. I feel pretty bored, so I feel like I
need would it to be the that. First thing you do when you kind of like gain consciousness in the morning? Like you roll over, take your phone out, and check your Twitter.
No, not okay. I didn't go that far.
Okay,
yeah,
but it would be in the morning, yeah, for sure. Like after I got up, got ready, logged into work, checked emails. Check the news, whatever. By lunchtime, I'm checking Twitter, you know, for sure.
Yeah. Adam, what about you?
It was a little bit of that. But also I think it was just, I was feeling like my mental health was taking it. Like I was feeling worse
for being
part of Twitter, right? Like I wouldn't open it and read whatever and feel informed or feel good, or it wasn't even neutral. It would just piss me off or get me angry or make me sad or something. And I realized that I wasn't really getting anything out of it. That was positive, at least. And if I wanted to inform myself, there are plenty of other ways to find out what's going on from just like a news perspective than using Twitter.
Like, what would make you mad? I mean, like, Teen talked about like the xenophobic stuff mostly. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff. Specifically for me, you know, just some, you know, adoption stuff and opinions. Hearing about how some people I would follow were being treated. Because thankfully I wasn't really, you know, the target of a lot of vitriol, but the opinions and the way that people talk to other people on there would piss me off. And then I'm like, what am I doing? If I respond, how is this doing anything? It's not really. I can spend my time, offline, chatting with people or talking with people on the phone or making connections over email that are much more fruitful than like owning them on Twitter, right? Like, just what's it doing?
Yeah. What do you guys think you were, in the best idealized form of Twitter experience that besides the more base impulses of wanting to feel angry or to own somebody, what was like the highest ideal of using Twitter?
I think, two things. One is, and Adam, I bet you feel the same way. Like, I don't think Twitter's like this awful thing. I think like you can have a good relationship with Twitter. I just think that it was starting to become a little bit dysfunctional for me. But I, like, number one, I met a lot of people on Twitter that I think I'm very happy I met, like Kyle, Pix, and they've come on. And I think part of it was like, I know them now, so I don't need Twitter to stay in touch with them.
Right, exactly.
Right, and there are plenty of people, they may not have my direct contact, so I've left like an alternative email there for me, for people to find me. But like, I'm not hard to find, right? So if they want to find me, they can always contact us through the pod, or they can contact someone who does know me, like Kyle or Pix or whatever, and ask for my email address, right? So that's number one, was you can meet people off Twitter, but you can take those relationships offline, which I have.
Yes, exactly, right? Exactly.
And I know, like, Adam, you and Kyle, are working on stuff, and that's an offline, non-Twitter relationship now, right? So you don't need Twitter to stay in touch with him. And then, so that's one. So I appreciate Twitter for that. And then number two is, I mean, I've had a few of my tweets go viral, and I've wondered which ones. I've always wondered why do these catch on versus some others, and I realized like Twitter does. You know, your goal is in many ways to make viral tweets, right? You don't want to just get 40 likes. You want to get 2,000 likes, right? You want it to pass around, and in order to do that, I think you do have to really get to the heart of the idea you're trying to say. And you really gotta make your point at like in an elevator pitch, cut to the bone, right? Like straight away. Mm. Like no dancing around. You just gotta go straight for the point. And I thought that took some skill to do. And so I thought it was like the antithesis of doing like writing, you know, like more longer form writing. It was just like in this many characters, try and get your point across, you know, as sharply and succinctly as possible. Right? There's a skill to that.
Yeah, but there's also a danger to that, because I remember this was a Champagne Sharks episode. It's probably at least a couple years old. I forgot what the name of the guest was on. She's like a South Asian American writer. I think her name starts with N or something. But she also I think she was like one of the more early adopter users of Twitter, and she went off of it for a couple of years to focus more on kind of like longer form writing, which is what she'd always wanted to do, because I think she was a journalist. But I remember her saying on the episode, she realized that it's sometimes like an exclusive skill set. You can either be good at tweeting, or you can be good at more traditional writing.
Yeah.
And
that's
probably true.
It's not always going to be complementary. Like, it's kind of an either or. And she, one of her struggles was she'd been tweeting so much that it had come at the expense of her ability to write. And, you know, hopefully she kind of regained that ability, but it's not entirely harmless if your objective is not just to be, you know, the world's greatest tweeter.
I sort of instinctively agree with that, because I haven't done much writing since I've been on, you know, really busy on Twitter. So, you know, it's not like it fosters writing.
Yeah, and I think that's...
It fosters more tweeting.
Yeah. Yes. What is it? I think that is my... Like, I've always been very kind of cagey on Twitter. I've always treated it as... I've always assumed one of my haters was like policing everything I said. So I'm like, I'm not going to say anything that they can get put out of context. I'll say if, you know, because, you know, you get more room with articles, well, even podcasts. What was I going to say? Right. So, another reason that I've kind of been wary of Twitter is like, you are giving away stuff for free. And not just in a monetary sense, but I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, people getting their ideas stolen and things like that. So it's like, okay, you're putting all this effort away from something you truly want to do for what, really? It's like, okay, you got some more followers, you got some more retweets and likes. But assuming that you want to do that to an end, let's say, like someone like me, like I'm really interested in, you know, writing and stuff. If that's your ultimate interest, why not just do that more, devote more of your time to that rather than hoping that devoting 90% of your energy into this endeavor will lead to the thing you really want to do at the risk of somebody else like taking your stuff.
But the way you've said that is, it's probably an objective description of what's going on, but it doesn't describe the subjective feeling of Twitter, because Twitter is not, it doesn't feel like it's requiring energy. Like, you don't sit down and think, I'm going to do a little tweeting today. You know, whereas when you write, you're like, I'm going to sit down, I got to write. Or if you're going to do anything, like any kind of, you know, sort of thing that takes more focus, you're like, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to do this. Never did I sit down and think, okay,
tweeting time.
Tweeting today. It's a very like effortless thing. It's like a little thought. You know what it is? It's like, it is the length of the tweet sort of matches up with like, you know, an idea, like the amount of the content of an idea that like pops into your head. It's not like a thought out thing, you know, it's like a idea pops into your head and then you're like, I could tweet that.
It's, you know, like a stream of consciousness.
It's a stream of consciousness. Yeah, exactly. Right. And these are thoughts that don't take a lot of effort. They're just like these thoughts that pop up and then you're like, you're like, I'm going to tweet that.
I agree with you, Teen, that the act of tweeting, just sort of like physically tapping it out and sending it, right? And most of the time you're also not even like baking the idea for that long, right? Like, as you said, it like sort of pops into your head, and as you get better at tweeting, maybe it just sort of comes out in a more viral or more potentially viral way. But even if that's true, and I think that's true, I found it to be very enervating, though. Like, it drained my energy. Like, the which sort of seems like a contradiction, but like, even though like the physical act of tweeting that doesn't take a lot of energy, unlike the physical act of like writing and the writing process, longer form writing process, just being involved with Twitter, like, you know, took a lot of my own energy and time. And I felt like it, like you mentioned about how like it is good for making connections with some people, right? And I've made some really good, you know, met a lot of great people, formed friendships. But and like what you were saying, Chris, like I realized like that there are other things I want to be doing, that, you know, I'm not doing because I'm taking time to like tweet. And I'd rather like put energy and time into those other endeavors than whatever time I was doing on, you know, spending on Twitter. And I was spending a fair amount of time on Twitter, yeah, right? Like it was
starting to bother me. I was like, wait, yeah. When I thought about it, I'm like, wait, I was on Twitter like half the fucking day. Like I gotta stop this.
I wasn't quite at the Elon Musk level where it's like 24/7, but you know, it was a good amount of my waking hours. I was like, this is too much.
I also felt like I just stopped meeting new people. It was the same people. And I was I don't need to keep in touch with these people on Twitter. I can keep in touch with them off of Twitter. You know?
Do you guys know who Emily Gould is?
Yeah.
Okay. So she is, Adam, do you know who Emily Gould is?
No, that doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. So she was a writer, most kind of well known, I think, in the early 2010s. I think she was a writer for Gawker. I think she and Lena Dunham had an infamous feud because I think she accused Lena Dunham of basing Hannah, the character of Hannah, on girls on her or something. So that tells you everything you kind of need to know about her. But she wrote this great essay, basically all about her regrets as a writer, because she kind of flamed out. You know, she became very notorious for being this very mean, snarky writer, I think, on Gawker. And then she got this big book deal, and then she published the novel, which I've read. It's very not good. And she kind of, you know, she, because of her like big advance and everything and the way that things work in the publishing world, that kind of means if you don't make it back, nobody wants to touch you anymore. So sure, anyway, yeah. One of the things she would discuss is she would have this deadline coming up, and instead of actually writing, she would just tweet a ton, and she would convince herself that this was actually part of the writing process. Like technically she's writing, she's gotten out a certain number of words, and hey, maybe it's helping her, visibility, or, you know, if she gets more followers, it kind of indirectly helps her as a writer. But she was like, no, it really wasn't writing. It was just me procrastinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you guys talked about meeting people through it. And I also think that is the best use of it. So I think the ideal way is just leave it, like Tina, I also wouldn't delete your account, but just leave it kind of as like a postal box or whatever. So that people, well, I guess you don't use your real name, so that's a little different. But you know, for me, like I use my real name, and if you ever do publish articles, they will ask for a Twitter account. And it's certainly less intrusive than say giving away your personal email, and then people can DM you on Twitter if they, you know, like other things you do outside of Twitter. So I think that's probably the best way, because, you know, when you first start out, you have like, you know, zero followers and following nobody, it's kind of a uphill climb. But, you know, we've had it for a while. We have a decent number of followers so that it doesn't look like we're bots. So, you know, if people look us up, we'll be there, and, you know, they can reach out to us if you want. And I think that serves, as I said, the highest ideal of Twitter, which is to connect people with like-minded strangers.
I'm going to tell Shan that. I'll say, Chris said I shouldn't delete it. Chris is a smart man.
Atin, how many tweets have you tweeted? You know, you see the counter. Like, what, last time you checked?
It's a lot. It's a lot. And I also, at many several points, went and deleted all my history. So whatever's there is probably like only half of what was ultimately.
Yeah. I think sometime last year I like deleted, I scrubbed like everything before, let's say, summer of 2021 or something. And I think I was around somewhere like 7,000-8,000 tweets, I think. So now I'm down to like 800. And
dude. And you don't even tweet as much as like I did or team did. And you had 7,000? Right.
I just felt like I had some cringe shit when I first started on Twitter, and like I could go one by one and do, but whatever. It's like, let's expunge that from the record. If somebody is so obsessed with me that they screenshotted it, then let that be, whatever. I don't think I've ever said anything that I can't defend anyway, but still, it was just like, I don't want that around. So Yeah. Like, would you ever think about just wiping out more teen?
Wiping out what?
Like more tweets. Like you would still have your account, but you'd be like, okay, let's delete everything before like 2022.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I don't really care about the tweets. I mean, it is a collection of shame, you know, like not so much that I don't like my own tweets. It's more like what, like, even though this didn't feel like work, that is still work. Like that, if I was to look at a montage video of myself tweeting, sort of bent over, like looking at my bright phone in a dark room, or, you know, like sort of like shirking work while just on my computer, just tweeting and then getting emotional about it. I'm like, why did I do this?
Yeah.
What? I don't have anything to show for any of this. It's just a bunch of shitty tweets. And then I have 8,000 some followers. Who are these people? I don't care about these people. I don't even know who they are.
Somebody just in the last hour followed me on Twitter. I'm sure she's a bot. Her name's Mary Walton, and her bio is, "I'm a single woman with no kid, need a husband." It's like, what the hell? Like,
that's definitely a bot.
And it's just like, what is this shit? But as I said, it is very nice to give people a chance to like reach out, or vice versa. If I want to reach out to someone, I'm not a big Instagram user, and Instagram's not as conducive to meeting, you know, strangers or exchanging ideas. Facebook, you know, forget about it. TikTok, hell no. So, you know, this is what we've got so far. I guess Reddit's the other one. Speaking of Reddit, okay, so just before this podcast, totally by coincidence, I went to a Michelle Branch concert last weekend.
Nice. And
Michelle Branch.
I love Michelle Branch.
And the last time I went to a Michelle Branch concert was around this time in 2017 at the exact same venue, Webster Hall. So I was just curious. Yeah, what was I? Because I wrote about it in my journal like years ago then. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm curious like what was going on in my life back then. So I was reading it. But that was 2017, and it's like leading up to the end of summer of 2017. Coincidentally, that was also when Plan A got started. So I was reading through all these entries where I'm like, oh, I met Teen for the first time. I met Adam for the first time. And I remember thinking at the time, okay, Plan A was essentially me saying, okay, enough of Reddit. I want to do the next thing. So if this is us now saying, all right, Twitter, enough with that. Let's do the next thing. What do you guys think the next thing is? Because we are doing Plan A. We already did the pod. What is up next? Because I think, like, you guys were talking about, you know, because I think the whole reason we did things like Reddit and even Plan A was we felt like it was really hard to meet like-minded people in real life. We either had to go into these online spaces like Reddit or later on Twitter, and also like write these articles that were like flares, you know, shot up in the sky. Hey, find us, come get us. But now I think, now that we've done that, we have enough of a kind of like our own circle, our own network of people or places we feel like we could go in person to find. And I think that is that's always been our ultimate goal, to go beyond just internet spaces and actually have, you know, like real life friends and, you know, other people who kind of share similar views. And I think that's the next step. But also, you know, writing more, less like ephemeral stuff, you know, like a tweet can go viral one day and then the next week it's just like you can barely find it because it just gets buried under another million tweets. But let's say you write a piece, hell, you might even write a book or other projects like that. That has more lasting value. I think that is the next step.
Yeah, I'd like to write more. I'd like to just be like, look, if I've got it in me to do like 20,000 tweets.
Wait, let's do the math. Okay, yeah. 20,000 tweets. Let's say each tweet is... Wait, the character limit is what? 400 characters?
I've turned a thread...
240, I think.
I've turned a thread of about... probably like 15 tweets into an article. One about blockchain. And, you know, it's a lot of words, man. It's a lot of words. I don't know what the calculation would be, but it would be a lot of articles. I mean, most of them are not article worthy. And a problem is a lot of them are repetitive. You're saying the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
That was the quality of Twitter that made me want to quit. I was like, I am stuck in a loop. There's nothing inherent about Twitter that was a problem for me, other than I was circling the drain, you know, around and around. And then I was becoming like Bill Murray in that in Groundhog's Day. It was like, I log in, I know exactly what I'm going to be confronted with. I know, you know, and you just, some days you just go through the motions. And I'm like, why am I doing this? It was just that circularity that was driving me insane. Yeah. And so whatever I do now, it's like, I just don't want to be repetitive. I want to do something where it's like, I actually get better at this. And then I build up, you know, some forward progress here, you know?
Yeah. So. Another thing that makes Twitter very alluring is kind of like the instant feedback, positive feedback. Yes, nobody can downvote you on like Reddit.
That's a big deal. That is
true.
And I think that is what draws people in. Like, let's say you're going to write an article. That's going to take several months. And, you know, who knows what the payoff will be at the end. If you're going to writing a book, even worse, it could take years. It might not even get picked up at the end. You could just sit on your shelf or something. With Twitter, you know, within maybe a couple hours, you know, if people respond positively to it, and you'll rack up followers and stuff. And it's probably good at an early stage. Let's say you're not very confident in your ideas. You're like, I need to get it out there, kind of run it by people, see if I'm not a total kook. Well, actually, no, but you could be a total kook and you just find your own kooks and they'll give you bad encouragement. That's another issue. But at a certain point, I think it is, hey, you know what? This is too easy. I gotta challenge myself more. And it's nice. It's like junk food, you know? It's like, is it, a little bit is fine, you know? And you can even like just eat chips for a whole day. It's not bad if you do it like once in a while, but if it becomes like your daily diet. Nutrition, you're gonna get horribly unhealthy.
Yeah. So I would not put out a general like, oh, hey, you know, Twitter rots your brain and social media is like terrible, cut it out. I think that's overstating it, but if you start feeling, if you yourself are like, dude, why did I tweet? Like, if you have that thought of like, why did I spend so much time tweeting today? It's probably time to get off of Twitter. You know?
Yeah.
So just follow that instinct of like, I don't feel like I'm, you know, I ate too much shit, you know, like I ate too many fucking potato chips, like that kind of feeling. Yeah. Get off. Yeah. Stop it.
All right. Well, we were talking about writing articles. Let's move on to the second half of this episode, where we will go in depth into this article that, you know, I briefly mentioned at the beginning, the one in The Nation by Seth Berkman, which is the title, "We Were Supposed to Help Asian Migrant Women. Instead, We Got Police." So, I mean, before you guys chime in, I'll just give the gist of this this article, which I read for the first time just before this pod. It's about this. The writer is saying how the Atlanta spa murders, specifically, but then also just like all the attacks on relatively high profile attacks on Asian Americans in the last couple of years have the whole like Stop Asian Hate kind of, not like I think just the movement itself, but just that sentiment has been hijacked by what he calls the aesthetic activists, which he is like a collection of either naive people who are easily kind of co-opted by kind of like the establishment, especially like the police, or they're kind of nefarious right wingers / techies who are either trying to push a right wing agenda or just in it for themselves, trying to promote their NFTs or whatever, and standing on the other side, on the heroic side of righteousness, is the Asian American Feminist Collective and Red Canary Song, a group that we potted with, and I think Red Canary Song is pretty cool. Asian American Feminist Collective, I mean, based on who they're associated with like Jen Fang and those types, I'm much more wary of. But that's the gist of this piece. So what did you guys think?
I don't understand the, I mean, we were talking about this before we started podcast. I don't understand the line that he's drawing.
Yeah.
But because like, okay, so for example, like I think everything he wrote here is crap. Okay. But like, when he talks about this theatrical activism, he said that includes, I mean, it's just dripping with condescension, right? There's this, let me find it real quick. Sorry, let me do a control F. Okay, so he says, after the Atlanta shooting, a wave of mostly young rookie activists were energized, but their ideas for action were calls for more representation and Band-Aid solution to protect Asian communities, like spending a weekend afternoon holding a self-defense class, walking elders to the subway, and handing out whistles and pepper spray. The performative acts were dutifully captured for Instagram with hashtags like Stop Asian Hate. Okay, everything about this fucking sucks. Number one is calls for more representation. Who's calling for more representation? He's clearly describing Dragon Combat Club. And I know those guys, and they hate representational politics. And then nothing that they spent here, that they said, spending a weekend afternoon holding a self-defense class, walking elders to the subway, handing out whistles and pepper spray. None of that's representation.
Right.
So they also sound like extremely good practical solutions that normal people can do.
Right.
How is walking elders to the subway, and it's actually walking elders to and from the subway, helping them carry bags or whatever. How is that performative? What, who are you performing for? I didn't see them doing that. What are they talking about?
It's also like he implies that they like did it once just for like a photo op. Like,
no, they do it all the time.
They do it all the time. This is like something they do constantly.
Yes. And when you see people who are trying to think outside of the quote, like, we can talk about this carceral stuff in a sec, but like, people who are saying like, look, we can't just rely on cops. They're saying stuff like, what if, you know, I'm thinking maybe like Asians, instead of bitching, could put together like, I don't know, community patrols that help, you know, that sort of like escort people at night or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, they're already fucking doing that. This is what walking elders, that's what this is. But then he's going to call it
aesthetic.
Performative.
Right.
What is he talking? Who is this fucking guy?
Okay. The key word in that sentence is rookie activists. These are the veteran activists who are threatened because for whatever reason, they're not getting enough time, attention, and money. And instead, they feel like they're getting overshadowed by these groups. It's basically like on a sports team, it's the old guys being threatened by the rookies. They're like, you young fellas, you don't know the way, you know, you might jump higher than me, you might be faster than me, but trust me, I know how to win championships. It's that kind of bullshit. Because, like, for example, walking elders to the attack, that's the exact type of solution that the Seth Berkman allies would say is the antidote, not carceral solutions. Yet in this sentence, he says that's actually performative. So it's like, what is the solution that you want? I'll tell you what the solution he really wants: more funding for these think tanks and nonprofits, so that they can come up with like something like the Asian American Disinformation Report, which one of the people named in this article, Rachel Kuo, who's apparently one of the like presidents of the Asian American Feminist Collective, she was one of the key architects of that report. So that's what they're saying the real solution is. No, don't do this thing where you're actually out there helping people. Oh, one of the solutions that we ourselves often cite as one of the things to do. No. You got to give us the money. You got to give us the speaking gigs. You got to give us the book deals and all that. That's what this article is really about. It's a factionalism debate and nothing to do with ideas, because a lot of these ideas are not mutually exclusive and a lot of people espouse them.
Yeah. Exactly. We know all these people. Ron Kim's in this fucking thing. I mean, we know these people, right? So he's pitting Dragon Combat Club against like Ron Kim. I'm like, why? I don't see any fucking division between this at all.
Yeah.
Red Canary Song and Ron Kim go together, sure. Dragon Combat
That's
Club.
How we even met Red Canary Song in the first place, through Ron Kim.
Well, I think he's putting them on the same side of stuff, but I'm saying like...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I don't see... Okay, but I'm at Seth Berkman's website, sethberkman.squarespace.com, and it's nothing but pushing a book that he published a while ago called A Team of Their Own. And it's about...
I think he's a sports writer. I went through his... He's got a bunch of stuff on New York Times. Most of it's on sports. I honestly thought this... Because he must be like a Korean adoptee, because he said he was born...
Well, he is. So, I've met him like a few times.
Okay.
But anyway.
And so he's calling this performative activism or whatever. And I'm looking at his website and it's like December 2020 selection for Stephen Curry's underrated book club. 2019 Best of, ESPN's The Undefeated, Minnesota Public Radio, and Outside Magazine. Okay, so what do? You're hawking a book, and you're calling other people performative activists because they're helping elderly people from the subway to their homes so they don't get attacked? Yeah. Sorry, man, fuck you. You're an asshole.
Also, we all... Like in the general sense, we all hate like aesthetic activists as well. But notice who he doesn't call out. Remember, just like, was it a month ago, that stupid Huffington Post article by that woman who was like, okay, We've talked enough about actual violence. Why don't we talk about the real problem, which is my dating problems with like white dudes? Why not call that up? Oh, it's because that she's probably kind of buddies with the whole Asian American, you know, feminist collective and their whole crowd. Like that's the untouchable topic. So that is actually not aesthetic activism. That's actually real activism somehow. Meanwhile, teaching elderly how to protect themselves or actually protecting them in their day-to-day life, that's performative. It is such bullshit. It's why Stop Asian Hate was bullshit from the get-go, and nobody should have any faith in any of the leaders of that so-called movement.
Yeah, this whole article is just really very confusing. Like, and it's not like I know Seth that well, but I think I get, I don't know, angrier or more disappointed when I feel like Asian adoptees are used as sort of like Asian enough, but also like white enough. And it's like, he's like perfectly positioned to be a pawn. And I don't know if he, you know, I don't know if he believes that he was used, but he was used. And you know, that...
Wait, sorry, I missed that. You said he was used by... Who do you think he was used by?
I think he's being used by, you know, the Jen Fangs and the, you know, the Asian American Feminist Collective, or like this particular nonprofit or activist crowd. And also sort of he's being used by the nation to launder these ideas, right? Like he's Asian enough so that like people can't be like, oh, this was written by, you know, like a non-Asian person. It's like, so he has a, what's the word I'm looking for? He's, he's got some standing there, but you know, he's not too Asian, so he's not going to be too biased. Right.
Yeah.
So I it's mean, just we, like a weird,
I mean, there, weird. There's in this whole kind of activist, you know, pseudo intellectual world, there is, some kind of battle going on that I think we can see kind of from a distance, but there's got to be something going on. Because we saw this with the whole freak out over Andrew Yang at the beginning, where like nobody even really knew that much about him, but there was like such a, like I thought, a disproportionate hatred of him. Like regardless of what he did after, it was, they didn't know that, you know, whatever stupid stuff he was going to say later. They didn't really know that. It just felt like, so I think the factions are, you have this kind of old school established academic class. These are like the old Asian, like, you know, descendants of kind of the Asian American studies tradition. You're, you know, Dr. Jen Hoes and, you know, like All Deaf, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, the whole nonprofit academic slash maybe even like journalism and writers, that kind of world. And I think the other side is very kind of tech funded. And I think the comparative advantages of both groups is the academic old school, they have access to white people, they have the credibility bestowed upon them by those white, and also I think a lot of you know, non-Asian minorities, especially black people, they have those connections, which lets them, at least in that little world, be the faces of Asian America. And then on the other side, you got the kind of newer kids on the block. They are more... Because they keep, like, you know, mentioning like NFTs and stuff. Like, what does, like, you know, it felt very odd that they would say things like that. So I think they feel like their biggest threat comes from this kind of new money crowd. They're probably more, less Asian American. They're probably a lot of like 1.5 gen, maybe even like first gen, maybe like more Chinese. I think definitely more, at least male coded. Notice how all the people they name as kind of like the either the dupes or the enemies. Like all the names they name, like Andrew Lee, Ben Wai, Jack Liang. And then it's so funny. They mention Evelyn Yang, Andrew Yang's wife. But then they also know, oh, she's married to Andrew Yang. So they have to like slip him in there too. And even BTS at the end, they're like, yeah, you know, BTS is like unfairly stealing all our attention. And there's some kind of civil war going on that we can kind of see, but I'm sure it runs like the details we don't quite know because we're not in that world. And we saw it, remember, with the freakout over JCK's book and how Dr. Jen Oh called him an MR Asian because of what? I've read that book. There's nothing. It's like, He's half of it's just about agent, him growing up playing sports, and the other half is, you know, it's like, yeah, it's
he did a lot of drugs, you know, that kind of thing.
It's a turf war. That's all it is. It's they're squabbling over the scraps over, yeah, this.
I was going to say that there are, I think there's that it's a turf war, but it's also, you know, I think that the reason this got published in The Nation, and this is, like you said, I think this is consistent with the disinformation thing. And like that, I think that this is really about showing what faction of Asian American writers, not even activists, because they don't give a shit about activists, but writers and media people, should be listened to in the mainstream media such that they will be sort of playing, they'll be supportive allies of the liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Because the last thing they want,
yeah,
is to deal with a law and order backlash to the liberal progressive agenda. Because, not for any other reason, and it has nothing to do with whether people care about Asians or don't care about Asians or whatever. Nobody cares about anybody. What this is about, ultimately, I think, when you look upwards, is preventing there being a large-scale schism within the Democratic Party, similar to the one that we saw in the Republican Party, a sort of populist revolt. And it's happening. And again, it goes back, I think this all started in San Francisco and the Chesa Boudin recall. And this is why they keep using that term carceral. Now, I want to ask someone like Seth Berkman if he were to ever come talk to us, but he won't. I know this because he's not about debating these issues. He's about performing for the right audience. But when you talk about the Atlanta spa shootings, are you saying that we shouldn't throw that motherfucker in prison? What do you mean by we shouldn't want carceral solutions? Are you saying that guy who murdered, you know, a shitload of people,
right,
that he shouldn't go to prison? Is that what you're saying? What does this mean? What does that have to do with carceral solutions and supporting carceral solutions?
Well, he can't say it out loud, but what he would probably say, let's say we had a few beers and he was like, off the record, he can go to jail because he's white. That's that we all know. That's what.
Okay, so the guy who killed Nash, the guy who killed Chris, raped and stabbed Christina Unalee to death, should he not go to prison? He's black.
I think they would. I don't know. I mean, like, well, it's. I think it crosses so many, because it's like, okay, if you let him go free, you're against Asian women, but then if you make him go to jail, then, or prison,
right, you're being anti-black, people, right? Yeah.
And it's extremely inconvenient for them socially.
So he has no position. Look, I'm just curious. I'm like, when someone murders someone, are you saying that we shouldn't put that person in prison behind bars? Like, I don't care about the race. Because as far as I know, when we first started talking about prison reform in this country, it really had to do, everyone that was talking about moving away from carceral solutions was really talking about non-violent crimes.
Right. Right.
Okay. And if you want people to support now it's true, like America has, the United States has by far the highest incarceration rate of any country on earth, including Russia or what, Cuba, all the ones that you think about that are, you know, just gulags. Okay. We have a larger prison population, both in terms of per capita
and like total actual numbers. Number. Yeah.
Yeah. Including India and China, which have like four times, you know, five times the number of people we do, whatever, right? Okay. It's true. We have a fucking prison problem. And it's racist. It's incredibly racist. So I agree that's a problem. Now, when people first started talking about this was limited to non-violent offenders. But now we're talking about, in the same fucking article, like in the headline, that we shouldn't support carceral solutions in the case of a mass murderer?
Right.
I don't understand what this guy's talking about.
They can't they can't.
What
support
his real position is don't make us say it. That's the injustice. Like,
what does that mean,
Asian,
don't make us say it?
like, don't make us be the one, like Asian Americans or like Asian Americans like him, be the ones to say, yeah, if you, let's say like a black person attacks an Asian person, he or she needs to be imprisoned. Everyone kind of implicitly understands because it's like so ridiculous to not to think otherwise.
Yeah.
But don't make us be the ones to have to say it. That's the real racism. Because then it's going to be extremely bad for my social standing. You're going to make me a pariah in my workplace or in my among my friends or something.
I mean, obviously, so, I don't care about that. Nor right. should anybody.
But these people, to them, their lifestyle comfort, it should be the number one priority of all racial activism. Well, you see it in everything they do. That's what they fundamentally believe, no matter what they say. So all these Asians dying is making it, making their lives very uncomfortable. That's what the real problem is.
It's just intolerant. Like, it's just, I mean, I've been thinking about trying to write a response article to this, but I'm like, you know, I mean, someone's got to respond to this shit.
Right. But another thing that's so pathetic about this piece is, as I said, if there's any group of Asian Americans who've been given have been anointed with the attention and the money of being like the conscience, the liberal conscience of Asian America, or the conscience in general, it's these people. But
you think so? Are you sure? Because I'm not. I think he got this published in The Nation, but I don't think The Nation really stands behind this. You know, I think it's,
well, they stand by it more than, say, like a China Mac, right?
I don't know. I mean, China Mac is not a, you know, he's not going to be writing articles for The Nation. I understand, but like, I do think that there's room for a counterpoint to this, because I'll tell you why. This is the Law and Order backlash is coming. It's happening. And they gotta talk about this straightforwardly.
I think
that there are definitely a need and room for Asian American voices who are going to give a different side to this. And it can be done well. And I think that after the Chesa Boudin thing, there were a lot of liberals and Democrats that came out and said, hey, you know, maybe we need to rethink what's going on. Because I don't think that the answer to this is just everyone just puts, puts blinders on and pretends like this isn't happening. It is happening. There's a lot of crime.
Yeah. I agree that it's a mistake for them to just sort of shame people into, you know, that question sort of the anti-carceral message. Like,
yeah, well, there can be room, but at this moment, there is nobody really occupying that space. So these, like the Seth Berkman type, are the ones who have been given that platform. And now he's like whining in this piece that these rookies have essentially taken over. Then like, well, if they could take over that easily, then you never had any standing with your own community to begin with. So you're like making a bad case for yourself either way.
But this is my point. And I talked to like Andre Domis. He's talked about this. I know Trevor has brought this up with us before, that look, at this point, and this is kind of in line with me quitting Twitter, is like, let's stop bitching. Because we all understand that we hate this shit, right? Like, for those of us that get this. Why is it just Seth Berkman that's sending... And now, Chris is different because he's been writing for and trying to get his stuff out there. We need more of that. Like, you know, this is just reading this stuff, I'm like, they publish it in The Nation, and then they get backlash on Twitter by people who are, you know, don't abide by the editorial standards of these publications and are just like, and I'm probably more guilty than anyone of this, going on a tirade on Twitter against this stuff, which is not as convincing. It is not as legitimized as someone who sits down, writes a very well thought out and politically expedient response to this. Someone who not only knows how this is wrong, but sees how that there is a different politically expedient view to be expressed here as well. Not just fuck this guy, which I want to say, but also like, look, this is a losing view for the Democratic Party. This is a pointless, mindless abuse of the idea of anti-carceral solutions.
Yeah. Yes.
You're abusing that term.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yes, absolutely.
I think I think I said this before, but I think it was a bonus app, and I think it was you and me, Teen. So I'll just repeat it because this is going to be a free episode. But yeah, so earlier this year, I got a piece published in Current Affairs, and the biggest lesson to me with that was it, like, I think the Asian American blue checks will try to make it seem as if they're the only ones saying anything intelligent or sane or, you know, interesting, and that every other Asian American should shut the fuck up, maybe go on some, you know, dirty corner of Reddit, and that's where you belong. But, you know, Current Affairs, they have no invested interest in Asian American stuff. They have no bias. You know, they just saw my pitch, and they were like, okay.
Interesting.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I'm sure the nation is similar.
I'm sure the nation is probably
similar. Yeah, so they just, I think a
we
lot
know
of...
We know Tim Shorrock, who's been on the pod, and he writes for the nation.
Yeah.
So these, like, however, like stridently these Asian American blue checks try to gatekeep, they're like trying to defend a goal that's like 20 feet wide, and they're just like,
People. They're trying to gatekeep, and but they don't even actually have any power to do it, right?
Right.
So their strategy, like, to gatekeep is
quite quite big, and right. I think for a while they've been able to fool a lot of us into thinking they got this on lockdown, and there's no hope. Well,
that's what I mean, right? So their only play is to discourage people from actually writing, or you know, sort of waste their energy by you know, going on tirades. When, you know, so they don't really have any power to, like, stop a well thought out pitch and an actual article to be published by the nation. They don't control the nation. They're just trying to get people to waste their energy not writing that piece.
Yeah, because once you do get published by, like, not the nation specifically, but like of these places, you also start meeting people outside of your, you know, Asian American circles, and you find a lot of people actually agree with what you're saying, like. Teen, that thing that happened to us that night at Scratcher.
Right, right.
Where the baffler guy overheard our conversation and, or more like your rant.
Yeah.
And he was totally in agreement. And I bet a lot of the, you know, Wilfred Chan types would have thought you were like a Han supremacist for saying what you did or whatever. But that dude was like, I agree everything with what you said. So that's what these, like, Asian American blue checks are afraid of, that once you get, and we've said this, like, ever since day one, it was just, they're afraid that once you get out of your bubble, or the bubble they impose on you, that they can't control you.
Okay, agreed. We're all agreeing in this, right? Now, you asked the question, what's next for us, right? We all were on Reddit, we got off Reddit, did our plan A, we all got on Twitter, now we're getting off Twitter. Like, this is what I personally, I'm just throwing this out there as a proposition, right? What I'd like to see is for us to help start to create, and this is, I've thought about this in an abstract sense from the very beginning when I was on Reddit, and it came to me because I really felt that there was something lacking, which was a real intellectual community, meaning, like, not a political activist group, not you know, not volunteers, not activists, but people who thought a lot and wrote a lot, a community of this that thought and wrote based on some pursuit of truth, okay? What I'd like to see is the beginning of that type of, like, a intellectual community, whether it's based online, I don't know how to organize it or whatever, but there's so many tools to do this now. It's so easy. Of people who we get to know each other, like we know each other, and we help each other write articles, and let's get them published. You know what I mean? And I've heard Q talk about this, and I've heard Trevor talk about this. Like, it's time to stop complaining about the blue checks and admire them for what they do, which is they get together and they fucking endorse each other. They promote each other. They publish each other, right? Let's do that. Let's get a group of people, not just Plan A people, but most of us are going to be interested in this too, right? Let's start seeding, like, a real, like, community of a group, a writer's group, or whatever you want to call it. And the goal of it is just, what is our, like, what are the ideas that all of us want to promote? And how do these sync up? Like, how are these linked together? What kind of like picture can we put together that we think is actually missing and has truth value to it? Not just political value, you know, not just like helping, helping the Democratic Party or whatever so we can get NGO money or whatever, but real truth value, like people actually committed to pursuing some, you know, knowledge and truth about shit. And then like, let's support each other to go write good articles and then push them out. Let's, push them out to people that we know, try to get this stuff published. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah.
Next.
And I think actually like 5 years ago, that was the same idea, which is why we started Plan A. But I think now we're thinking bigger. Plan A was more insular. It was just more Asian American focused. It was just trying to even legitimize our ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Like I, for one, you know, I had all these thoughts, but I also was like, are these actual like legit thoughts, or, you know, am I just being a crank or something? I think 5 years later, we're more confident. Like, no, these are not only very good ideas, but we actually have a lot of unexpected like sympathizers and all that. So let's take that next step, which is kind of doing the same thing, but as I said, on a bigger scale.
Yeah. And we know a lot of people, yeah. I think.
Agreed.
I get emails from people who don't seem to know what they want, but they want us or me to like help them somehow. You know, like, or they want to come on the pod and talk about stuff. And I'm like, I kind of like, I don't know if that's really helpful for you. So what can be helpful is I think, and I think these people have, like, someone was contacting me recently about, you know, just like a huge amount of anti, or just a huge amount of like bad information out there when it comes to mental health services for Asian Americans and a lot of non-white peoples. And I'm like, look, this is a very serious problem. And I almost feel like, I can't do this thing justice because it's not like I know much about this. And, you know, the pod is not really the right media. It's just not going to do anything in this regard. But where does a person like that turn to? Like, where do you go to get support from other people to bounce ideas off of, listen to this person, maybe think of like, where can this person go to get out the thing that they want to say that's inside of them? And that's the thing that I felt from day one when I went on Reddit, because I was like, there's nowhere for people to turn to if they want to speak up about some of this stuff. There's no group. There's no community. It's just these rando people on Reddit, and they're average IQ is pretty fucking low, you know? So yeah, that's the, you know, and like you said, Chris, I think Plan A itself, you know, we did pay a lot of writers. We did publish a lot of articles and we wrote a lot of articles, but like you said, I mean, it's insular. It is good for communicating within group, but I think you're right. Like you said this before, you felt like you've exhausted a lot of the ideas that you wanted to write for something like Plan A, but there's more to it. And I think in that process of doing Plan A, we've all found ideas that really should get out there in the mainstream.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Agreed.
I think it's I don't want to talk to other Asian Americans anymore because I already know which ones I care about and which ones I don't. I've already, you know, like I've already decided which ones are worth my time and which ones are not. And let's find the ones that are worth our time and let's just like fucking fight back against the Seth Berkmans and the Jen Fangs of the world instead of cutting them down on Twitter, which is easy, and then you just get blocked and then it's bullshit. Like, let's just go and let's just offer the narrative that they don't want to get out, you know, instead of like personally insulting these people, which is fun. You know, I like to know that they know that, you know, people don't like them. That's great. But I would like to see the, you know, what really would fuck them up is to get those ideas out there, mainstream them, legitimized. And it's the very ideas that they so desperately, you know, want to condemn. You know, and honestly, I think people, there's people fighting the good fight. And I think JCK has written a lot of great articles out there and he's gotten them really mainstreamed and stuff. And I'm very appreciative that someone like him is doing that. There needs to be more of that. It can't just be like this one guy, you know?
Yeah. Maybe, maybe when we get more stuff published, he won't be so afraid to openly associate himself with us anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Did you see that tweet he made? His book is now on paperback, and he was like, "Please buy one and send one to my haters." Yeah. I know he was talking about Dr. Jen Ho after the way she went after him online.
You know what? Maybe I will buy one and send it to her. Print that.
Oh my god.
So okay. Well, I'm glad that you asked that question, Chris, because I've been thinking about it and. Yeah, that's what I'd like to see.
We've been thinking about it for a while. I remember when we were in Copaic. Remember, like first night, we were just like hanging out in the backyard, and we were talking about it. And it's a question worth thinking deeply about. It's not like a snap answer that we need, but it will determine kind of what we'll do for the next few years.
I'd like for us, like just the three of us, let's say. I'd like to have more time with you guys where we're talking about articles we're writing.
Mm-hmm.
Doing real deep dive, like really trying to do some work. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that would be to me a much, much better way to refocus all that time that I instead had been I don't want to say wasting, but yeah, wasting on Twitter. That it would be, I would be much more like if I had done that for years, the kind of thing that I'm proposing, I feel like I would feel really good about it. You know, like two, 3 years from now, if we're doing something like this, I would feel really good about it. Versus now, I look back on all this time on Twitter, I'm like, what was I doing?
Well, it's all part of an experience.
It is.
I think of
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like I think of some of the stuff I wrote. I mean, not for planning, but this is more in terms of like fiction, you know. But it's like it's all part of a process. Even the stuff you hate, you got to get that out. So if you hated the stuff you tweeted, you probably had to get it out of your system at least.
I didn't hate the stuff I tweeted. Hate the fact that I was I was throwing it all away on Twitter when I should have been honing it into, you know, like why am I letting a guy like Seth Berkman get away with writing shit like this? Why are any of us letting him get away with this without going right back to The Nation or something and saying, no, fuck this. And these are all the reasons he's wrong. And this is one of the most easily rebuttable, easily like, you know, just easily just like ripped apart articles I've ever seen, but no one's going to do it. And we should do it. It's, you know, they shouldn't get away with this shit is what I'm saying.
We need to go back to the days when there were tons of writer feuds.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that would be great. But unfortunately, no, there's no one on the other side of this or very few, you know? And I would like to, you know, and I think if people saw that there were serious-minded Asian-American writers who were going in to mainstream publications and taking aim at this stuff and seeing that that can get mainstreamed, that would be of great service to people, you know, because they wouldn't have to just get mad all the time and see themselves as you know, being defensive about stuff. They could say like
seize in private and, you know, grumble among their
and say, oh, we're being suppressed. Like you said, you know, these guys are chosen. No, they're not. You know what? I'm not sure they're chosen. I think that they're for whatever reason, these people are just fucking more motivated to mainstream their work. And for whatever reason, I don't know why. And then the people who get mad about what they say are not. And I guess, you know, to sort of summarize what I'm proposing is like, let's fight back and say, let's also say, okay, whatever these fucking idiots can do, we can do much better than this, but we're not doing better than this. And it's pissing me off.
I think they're chosen, but it's a very mild preference. It's more like because the powers that be really don't give a shit about Asian American stuff. Like, okay, you're there. I don't really want to expend more time and energy than I have to. So, okay, you're there. I guess you can do this or that. But that makes them easily challengeable.
I think they're chosen by default because there's no real opposition.
Yeah, they're just there.
Yeah.
They've just always been there. That's just kind of the, as I said, the activist academic tradition of Asian America for the last couple of decades. Yeah. So it's,
But I want this to be selective too. I know there's a lot of people who have a lot to say, but I want to deal with people who are actually going to be able to write really good articles. And I'm sorry, but that's not most people.
No, for sure. So, you know, I think we can try to do it ourselves. I mean, rather than trying to like teach people, let's actually try to do it ourselves.
I don't want to teach people. I'm just saying I want like-minded peers.
Yeah.
You know, that are serious about this and good at it.
We can only control ourselves. So I think if we start doing it more, people will come forward and we'll find. I mean, we've already started doing that over the last few years, but
yes,
as I said, the more we branch out beyond just like plan A, the more it'll happen at a faster pace.
Yeah.
Okay. That was a really good discussion. I think just starting from, you guys winning, not using Twitter as much. And
well, the last little thing I do want to say is about sort of like the next things that I'm going to be doing is I think Teen, you already sort of mentioned it earlier, but Colin and I are developing our own podcast. Can be focused on the adoption adoptees, but also very outward looking. We're going to be talking about just all sorts of, whatever is out there. That to me, that's always sort of something I've wanted to do is just focus more on that angle, that topic, and to put it out there for other people to listen to and hear.
That's very cool.
So that's coming.
He's great. He's fucking great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When it's about to launch, we should do a episode
promoting it for sure.
Yeah. Sounds awesome.
All right. Okay. I think we can call it an end to this episode. So thank you guys for joining me on this, and we'll talk again soon.
Bye.
All right. Bye, everyone.